Lincoln, Disc 13.
On the day after the Quincy debate, both Lincoln and Douglas got aboard the City of Louisiana and sailed down the Mississippi River to Alton for the final encounter of the campaign. Looking haggard with fatigue, Douglas opened the debate on October 15th in a voice so hoarse that in the early part of his speech he could scarcely be heard. After briefly reviewing the standard arguments over which he and Lincoln had differed since the beginning of the campaign, he made the peculiar decision to devote most of his speech to a detailed defense of his course on Lecompton. He concluded with a rabble-rousing attack on the racial views he attributed to Republicans and an announcement that the signers of the Declaration of Independence did not mean Negro, nor the savage Indians, nor the Fiji Islanders, nor any other barbarous race when they issued that document. In his reply, Lincoln said he was happy to ignore Douglas's long account of his feud with the Buchanan administration. He felt like the put-upon wife in an old jest book who stood by as her husband struggled with a bear, saying, "Go it, husband, go it, bear." Once again, he went through his standard answers to Douglas's charges against him and the Republican Party. Recognizing that at Alton he was addressing an audience having strong sympathies southward by relationship, place of birth, and so on, he tried to explain why it was so important to keep slavery out of Kansas and other national territories. This was land needed for an outlet for our surplus population. This was land where white men may find a home. This was an outlet for free white people everywhere the world over, in which Hans and Baptiste and Patrick and all other men from all the world may find new homes and better their conditions in life. And that brought him again to what he perceived as the real issue in this controversy, which, once more, he defined as a conflict on the part of one class that looks upon the institution of slavery as a wrong, and of another class that does not look upon it as a wrong. Rising to the oratorical high point in the entire series of debates, he told the Alton audience, "That's the issue that'll continue in this country when these poor tongues of Judge Douglas and myself shall be silent. It's the eternal struggle between these two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world. They're the two principles that have stood face to face from the beginning of time and will ever continue to struggle. The one is the common right of humanity, and the other the divine right of kings." With a brief rejoinder by Douglas, the debates were ended. After that, both candidates made a few more speeches to local rallies, but everybody realized that the campaign was over, and the decision now lay with the voters. It was hard to predict what that decision would be. Even an extremely conscientious citizen who made a point of attending all seven debates, or more probably, a voter who attended one of the debates and read the detailed accounts the newspaper carried of the other six, might find it hard to make up his mind. In terms of debating skills, he'd have to judge the two speakers as about equal, Douglas giving a much more impressive performance at the start, but Lincoln gaining in fluency and flexibility as the campaign progressed. Neither speaker exhibited the purest debating technique, enunciating a position, logically developing its implications, and systematically refuting the arguments of his opponent. The voter would have to give both Lincoln and Douglas passing marks for observing the amenities of debate, though there was a certain amount of horseplay. Douglas claimed that in his New Salem days, Lincoln could ruin more liquor than all the boys of the town together, a charge that was not merely inaccurate, but singularly inappropriate from a senator known to have a fondness for drink. And Lincoln jeered that Douglas's popular sovereignty doctrine was as thin as the homeopathic soup that was made by boiling the shadow of a pigeon that had starved to death. But on the whole, both men behaved with propriety. In the early debates, Douglas made a point of complimenting Lincoln's intelligence and ability, even while strongly disagreeing with his policies. Lincoln professed to be rather taken by the flattery, especially coming from so great a man as Douglas, and said he wasn't used to it. "I was rather like the Hoosier with the gingerbread when he said he reckoned he loved it better than any other man and got less of it." But he notably didn't reciprocate by complimenting Douglas. He found it hard to tell even a white lie. The informed Illinois voter would note, of course, that there was an enormous amount of repetition from one debate to another. Douglas used the same basic speech, with minor modifications, throughout the campaign. As Lincoln remarked, "The senator's successive speeches are substantially one and the same." Though more varied, Lincoln's speeches frequently included long-quoted passages from his previous addresses. And in several of the debates, he employed almost identical paragraphs or passages. There was no evidence that any considerable number of voters were concerned that the Lincoln-Douglas debates concentrated almost exclusively on questions relating to slavery. The speakers could have discussed other serious issues of great importance to a country just emerging from the panic of 1857. Regulation of banks, revision of tariffs, control of immigration, provision of homesteads for farmers, improvement of the lot of factory workers, and so on and on. But the debaters focused on none of these because they, and the Illinois voters, felt that the major concern of the country was the present condition and future prospects of the institution of slavery. By concentrating on slavery, Lincoln and Douglas naturally exaggerated their differences. In a less combative arena, they would have found much on which they could agree. For instance, both men disliked slavery. Lincoln openly deplored it, and Douglas privately regretted its existence. Both denounced the Lecompton Constitution as a fraud and wanted Kansas to become a free state. Indeed, that question had effectively been settled just before the debates began, when Kansas voters, on August 2nd, by a vote of 11,300 to 1,788, rejected the Lecompton Constitution, even with the incentives of a large land grant and the promise of early admission offered by the English bill. Neither man favored a slave code to protect slavery in the national territories, and neither would contemplate the extension of slavery into the free states. So numerous were their points of agreement, Lincoln candidly admitted at Jonesboro, that there was very much in the principles that Judge Douglas has here enunciated that I most cordially approve, and over which I shall have no controversy with him. But, of course, these were debates, not love feasts, and both men felt the need to stress the differences, real and imaginary, that divided them. Many of these were entirely immaterial to the 1858 Senate race. For instance, Douglas's repeated accusation that Lincoln had failed to support his country during the Mexican War had no conceivable bearing on the present contest, nor did his elaborate attempts to show that Trumbull had been guilty of the most infamous treachery in helping to defeat Lincoln's election to the Senate in 1855. It was hard to understand why Lincoln's tedious account of Trumbull's charges against Douglas, or Douglas's worrisome report of his differences with Buchanan, had any place in this canvass. Even the larger issues, over which the candidates did profoundly disagree, often had little practical relevance to this election. For example, the controversy over whether the framers of the Declaration of Independence intended to include blacks in announcing that all men are created equal dealt with an interesting, if ultimately unresolvable, historiographical problem. But it wasn't easy to see just what it had to do with the choice of a senator for Illinois in 1858. And the heated arguments over the capacity and the future of the Negro race, with related controversies over social and political equality of the races, while showing fundamental philosophical differences between the two candidates, didn't deal with any issue or legislation that was or was likely to be under consideration by the Congress of the United States. Many Illinois voters must have understood Douglas's exasperated query at the Charleston debate, "What question of public policy relating to the welfare of this state or the Union has Mr. Lincoln discussed before you?" But many must also have understood that the same objection could be raised with equal force against Douglas himself. Lincoln's friends thought he took a clear lead in the final three debates when he stressed the moral issue of slavery, and it was hard to resist the force of his argument. Douglas could only counter by showing that Lincoln's position was entirely negative. Lincoln was against slavery, but he offered no suggestion as to how it was to be placed in a course of ultimate extinction. For Douglas, the fundamental issue in the debates was self-government. In his mind, the right of Americans, whether in the individual states or in the territories, to determine their own form of government and their own social institutions, including slavery if they so desired, was a moral question, more basic than even the one Lincoln raised. In his final rebuttal in the last debate, he once more made his view explicit. "I care more for the great principle of self-government, the right of the people to rule," he told listeners at Alton, "than I do for all the Negroes in Christendom." With the basic differences so formulated, well-informed Illinois voters understood that what was at stake wasn't just the choice between two candidates or political parties. It was a choice between two fundamentally opposed views of the meaning of the American experience. One way to formulate that difference was to see Douglas as the advocate of majority rule and Lincoln as the defender of minority rights. In Douglas's view, there were virtually no limits on what the majority of the people of a state or a territory could do, including, if they so chose, holding black-skinned inhabitants in slavery. While Lincoln also valued self-government and would make no attempt to end diversity on, say, cranberry laws in Indiana and Illinois, he felt passionately that no majority should have the power to limit the most fundamental rights of a minority to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How much the Lincoln-Douglas debates affected the voters remained problematical even after the ballots were tallied. Though November 2nd was cold, wet, and raw, voters turned out in large numbers, more than in the 1856 presidential election. The Republican candidate for state treasurer received 125,430 votes. The Douglas Democratic candidate, 121,609. And the National Democratic Danite candidate, 5,071. Ballots for candidates for the state legislature were distributed in about the same proportion. As was expected, the Democrats carried all but three of the counties in southern Illinois, and also those along the Illinois River, while Republicans won all of the northern counties, many by heavy majorities. In general, counties that had substantial towns tended to vote Republican, while poorer, slower-growing counties voted Democratic. The 49 central counties, where both Lincoln and Douglas had done most of their campaigning, were closely divided. Since the name of neither Lincoln nor Douglas appeared on any ballot, there was no accurate way of measuring the personal popularity of either man or the impact of their campaigning, and analysts could adduce evidence to support opposite conclusions. On the one hand, it could be noted that in the state as a whole, Democratic votes significantly increased in 24 counties where both Douglas and Lincoln spoke, while Republicans gained votes in only 5 of the counties where both men appeared. On the other, the returns showed that the Republicans fared slightly better in the 7 counties where Lincoln and Douglas debated face-to-face than in the state as a whole. These contradictory statistics were less significant than the remarkable pattern of continuity demonstrated in the 1858 voting. The returns were closely similar to those in 1854 and 1856. The most immediate and obvious lesson of the election was that voting patterns in Illinois had become very stable, with the northern counties firmly Republican and the southern half of the state stalwartly Democratic. It was Douglas's split with the Buchanan administration and Lincoln's courtship of the Danites that gave Republicans a plurality and kept Douglas and his party from winning a clear majority in the state. Though Republicans won in the popular vote and elected their candidates for state treasurer and superintendent of education, they didn't gain control of the state legislature, which would choose the next senator. In the state Senate, 13 members were holdovers. The terms of senators were staggered, and 8 of these were Democrats. That meant that, in order to have a majority in a joint session of the two houses, the Republicans needed to have more than half the members in the new House of Representatives. But seats in the House were apportioned according to the population in the 1850 census. In the years since 1850, the northern section of the state, where the Republicans were strongest, had grown much more rapidly than the southern counties, which the Democrats controlled. Because of the apportionment law, Republicans, who received about 50% of the popular vote, won only 47% of the seats in the House, while the Democrats, with 48% of the popular vote, gained 53% of the seats. That seemed unfair, but even if representation had been apportioned exactly on the basis of population, the Republicans would still have won only 44 seats. Not enough, even when their 5 holdover senators were added, to elect Lincoln. In the balloting, on January 5, 1859, Douglas received 54 votes to Lincoln's 46, and was thus reelected for another 6 years to the United States Senate. After their defeat, many Republicans conducted postmortems on the election. The Rockford Register, along with many others, blamed the unjust apportionment of the state, which deprives the people of a representation according to their numbers. Others pointed to illegal voters, allegedly brought in by the Illinois Central Railroad to help the Democrats carry key counties, and Herndon claimed that thousands of roving, robbing, bloated, pockmarked Catholic Irish were imported upon us from Philadelphia, St. Louis, and other cities. Many condemned Horace Greeley and other Eastern Republicans for their lukewarm support of Lincoln. "Damn Greeley, etc.," exclaimed a voter from Paris, Illinois. "They've done Lincoln more harm than all others." Some thought that Crittenden's endorsement of Douglas influenced thousands of former Whigs and Americans, know-nothings, especially in the center part of the state, to go helter-skelter over to the Democrats. Though Lincoln wasn't surprised by the outcome of the election, he was bitterly disappointed. Once again, he saw a victory escape his grasp. With one more defeat added to his record, he'd received yet another lesson in how little his fate was determined by his personal exertions. At times, he felt very blue, and on the day the legislature elected Douglas, he was sure that his political career was ended. Confident only of the unquestioning loyalty of his partner, he remarked with some bitterness, "I expect everyone to desert me except Billy." But as a leader, he recognized his duty to cheer up his associates, who were also suffering from his defeat. "I'm glad I made the late race," he wrote his old friend Dr. Henry. "It gave me a hearing on the great and durable question of the age, which I could have had in no other way. And though I now sink out of view and shall be forgotten, I believe I've made some marks which will tell for the cause of civil liberty long after I'm gone. The fight must go on," he assured another friend. "The cause of civil liberty must not be surrendered at the end of one or even 100 defeats." Chapter 9. The Taste is in My Mouth. "This year I must devote to my private business," Lincoln vowed in 1859, declining invitations to speak. "I've been on expenses so long without earning anything that I'm absolutely without money now for even household purposes," Lincoln explained to Norman Judd. Accordingly, 4 days after the 1858 elections, Lincoln and Herndon appeared before the Sangamon County Circuit Court in a case where their client had to pay a judgment of $23 and costs. Other more remunerative cases followed during the next 12 months, but except for the celebrated Peachy Harrison murder trial, none was of any special importance. As always, Lincoln was careful in his preparation and dependable in his court presentation, but the law had lost some of its excitement for him. At times, his letters to clients sounded almost testy. To one who was dissatisfied with the way Lincoln was handling his suit, he wrote bluntly, "I would now very gladly surrender the case to anyone you would designate, without charging anything for the much trouble I've already had." It was politics that really interested him now. As the leading Republican in Illinois, he felt a great responsibility in planning for his party's victory in the upcoming presidential election of 1860. To win, it was necessary to keep the fragile Illinois Republican coalition together, to block extreme or diversionary moves by Republicans in other states, and to select a presidential nominee who could combine the votes received by Fremont and Fillmore in 1856. After the defeat in the senatorial election, the Illinois Republican coalition threatened to disintegrate. The party was in debt. Judd, the chairman of the state central committee, had incurred obligations of about $2,500 in addition to some $1,300 he'd paid out of his own pocket. Republicans who'd pledged contributions were reluctant to pay up, and Judd unhappily asked Lincoln to help him collect. Protesting that he was the poorest hand living to get others to pay, Lincoln promised $250 himself, and then, along with O.M. Hatch and Jesse Dubois, asked Newton Bateman, the state superintendent of education, for assistance. Phrased as a request, their letter was in fact an assessment on the newly elected official who owed his position to the Republican Party. Republicans in central Illinois were slow to contribute because many felt that in the recent campaign, the state central committee had slighted their section in favor of the Chicago area. Former Whigs like Judge David Davis resented the prominent role that former Democrats played in the campaign and correctly suspected that Judd was using his position as chairman of the Central Committee to promote his own gubernatorial prospects. Herndon was so vocal in charging Judd with misapplying party funds that the Chicago attorney had to ask Lincoln to curb his partner. Herndon gave a solemn promise to hold his tongue. But after this outburst, Lincoln no longer shared political confidences with his partner. A disruptive feud that continued to rage in Chicago between Judd and Wentworth was partly a personal vendetta and partly a bitter struggle for supremacy between Wentworth's Chicago Democrat and the Chicago Press and Tribune, which consistently supported Judd. In addition to assailing Judd's financial integrity, Wentworth accused him of conniving against Lincoln. Judd had helped defeat Lincoln's Senate bid in 1855. His mismanagement had brought about Republican defeat in 1858, and now he was plotting to promote Trumbull rather than Lincoln for the presidency. Judd, who desperately wanted to become governor, brought suit for libel, asking $100,000 in damages. Both men appealed to Lincoln for help. Wentworth tried to co-opt him by retaining him as his lawyer in the libel suit, while Judd insisted that he write a public letter vouching for his integrity. Lincoln attempted to remain neutral. He also tried to keep Republicans in other states from shattering the party harmony. When Republicans in Massachusetts, where nativism was strong, endorsed a constitutional provision requiring naturalized citizens to wait 2 years before they could vote, Lincoln expressed forthright opposition. "I have some little notoriety for commiserating the oppressed condition of the Negro," he explained, "and I should be strangely inconsistent if I could favor any project for curtailing the existing rights of white men, even though born in different lands and speaking different languages from myself." Similarly, when Ohio Republicans adopted a platform calling for the repeal of the Fugitive Slave Law, he bluntly warned Governor Salmon P. Chase that the cause of republicanism is hopeless in Illinois if it be in any way made responsible for that plank. "In every locality," he urged, "we should look beyond our noses and at least say nothing on points where it's probable we shall disagree." He continued to worry about the fatal attraction that Stephen A. Douglas had for many Republicans. Though re-elected to the Senate, Douglas had lost much Southern support because of his Freeport Doctrine. The almost unprecedented action of the Democratic Senate caucus in removing him from his cherished chairmanship of the Committee on Territories in December 1858 indicated just how few his Southern followers were. Shrewd and realistic, Douglas began making moves to attract backing from Republicans, just as he'd done in the Lecompton controversy. He reminded them that he'd consistently opposed enacting a slave code that would protect slavery in all the national territories, and had fought the reopening of the African slave trade, both measures dear to Southern extremists. Always suspicious of his great rival, Lincoln thought that Douglas was playing a double game. Douglas was presenting himself as a strong candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1860, but at the same time was so positioning himself that if the Democrats rejected him, he would bolt at once, turn upon us, as in the case of Lecompton, and claim that all Northern men shall make common cause in electing him president as the best means of breaking down the slave power. Lincoln knew that some Republicans, like Horace Greeley, had never recovered from their earlier infatuation with Douglas, and he was even more troubled when Kansas Republicans, after rejecting the Lecompton Constitution, and thus ensuring that their state would be free, began speaking of their victory as a triumph of popular sovereignty. In Lincoln's first political appearance after the 1858 campaign, he warned Chicago Republicans of the dangers of Douglasism. "Let the Republican Party of Illinois dally with Judge Douglas. Let them fall in behind him and make him their candidate, and they do not absorb him, he absorbs them." Lincoln's anxiety became greater when he read the long article, "The Dividing Line Between Federal and Local Authority, Popular Sovereignty in the Territories," which Douglas published in the September 1859 issue of Harper's Magazine. Taking as his texts Lincoln's House Divided speech and Seward's even more radical Irrepressible Conflict address, Douglas developed at great length his argument that popular sovereignty had consistently been the American policy from the days of the Revolution, that great principle meant that the people of every separate political community, dependent colonies, provinces, and territories, as well as sovereign states, have an inalienable right to govern themselves in respect to their internal polity. By fairly tortuous reasoning, he discovered that even the Dred Scott decision had recognized that right. He claimed that popular sovereignty, correctly construed, would block both the Republican efforts to exclude slavery from the territories by congressional act and Southern attempts to enact a national slave code. Widely discussed, if not widely read, Douglas's article was a bold attempt to create a new party of the center, one that would unite moderate Democrats and conservative former Whigs and reject both Southern and Northern radicals. To bring this message to a larger audience, Douglas welcomed the opportunity to participate in the 1859 Ohio campaign, where he supported the local Democratic candidates, but urged all conservative men, all lovers of peace and of the law, all friends of the Union, to rally in support of the great principle of popular sovereignty. Lincoln found Douglas's activities decidedly threatening. Considering the little giant the most dangerous enemy of liberty, because the most insidious one, he readily accepted an invitation from the Ohio Republican State Central Committee to participate in the campaign and thus to head off the little gentleman. He didn't appear on the same platform with Douglas in Ohio, but his speeches at Columbus, Dayton, Hamilton, and Cincinnati, September 16th and 17th, as well as one he delivered in Indianapolis 2 days later, were in effect continuations of the 1858 senatorial debates. For the most part, Lincoln presented arguments that he'd advanced during those debates, but he was now freer in his criticisms of Douglas, apparently taking to heart Joseph Medill's advice, "As you're not a candidate, you can talk out as boldly as you please. Don't fail to get off some of your anecdotes and bits. Hit below the belt as well as above, and kick like thunder." He took obvious delight in mocking what he called Douglas's great principle of popular sovereignty. As explained in 19 mortal pages of Harper, it amounted to saying that if one man chooses to make a slave of another man, neither that other man nor anybody else has a right to object. Lincoln now developed some elements of his argument more fully than he'd done in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. The real danger posed by Douglas, he explained, came from his gradual and steady debauching of public opinion. Douglas's attempts to prove that the Declaration of Independence did not include African Americans had already changed the way most whites viewed blacks. His recent remark that he was for the Negro against the crocodile, but for the white man against the Negro, helped spread the opinion that the Negro's no longer a man but a brute, that he ranks with the crocodile and the reptile. Public opinion in this country is everything, Lincoln observed, and Douglas and his friends were serving as the miners and sappers to undermine the resistance to the spread of slavery, so that state laws excluding slavery would soon be overruled, a national slave code enacted, and the African slave trade revived. In these 1859 addresses, Lincoln also elaborated on a subject that he'd slighted during the debates with Douglas, how the mass of white men are really injured by the effect of slave labor in the vicinity of the fields of their own labor. The argument required him to lay out his view of American economic development. Like Francis Wayland and the other political economists whose books he'd read years earlier, he firmly adhered to the labor theory of value. Labor is the source from which human wants are mainly supplied. Labor was thus prior to and independent of capital. Indeed, capital is the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor hadn't first existed. But capital, though derivative, performed a valuable service in a free society, because those who had it could offer employment to the prudent, penniless beginner in the world who owned nothing save two strong hands that God has given him and a heart willing to labor. If this novice worked industriously and behaved soberly, he could, in a year or two, save enough to buy land for himself, to settle, marry, and beget sons and daughters, and presently he too would begin employing other laborers, reminding his Ohio audiences that, "At an early age, I was myself a hired laborer at $12 per month." He insisted that in a free society, there was no such thing as a man who's a hired laborer, of a necessity always remaining in his early condition. Lincoln's version of the American dream was in some ways a curiously limited one. Confident that advancement was open to all who worked hard, He was untroubled by the growing disparity of wealth between the poor and the rich. Viewing himself as a man of the people, he didn't find it incongruous that some of his most loyal supporters were large-scale farmers like Isaac Funk of McLean County, who owned 25,000 acres of prairie land, and William Scully of Logan County, who owned 30,000 acres. Nor did he find it remarkable that his strongest political backer was David Davis, who was becoming one of the wealthiest landlords and land speculators in the state. Though Lincoln regularly represented railroads, the largest corporations in the country, he thought of economic opportunity primarily in terms of individual enterprise. In his analysis, he gave scant attention to the growing number of factory workers who had little prospect of upward social mobility. To the free economy that Lincoln idealized, he juxtaposed the slave society of the South. There, it was assumed that labor must always remain subordinate. There, as James Henry Hammond of South Carolina proclaimed, labor was the mud sill on which the social edifice was erected. In a slave society, Lincoln observed, a blind horse upon a treadmill is a perfect illustration of what a laborer should be, all the better for being blind that he couldn't tread out of place or kick understandingly. The free economy and the slave society had coexisted, more or less peacefully, since the founding of the Republic. But now they were increasingly in competition and conflict. Like most Republicans, Lincoln believed that slavery had to expand or die. The exhaustion of the soil and the natural increase of the slave population meant that slaveholders were forced to move into new lands. But free society had also the imperative to expand. The basic impulse to improve one's condition, an inherent right given to mankind directly by the Maker, required room. The national territories were God-given for that purpose, and he had long believed that their best use was for the homes of free white people. But if Douglas and the Southern Democrats had their way, free laborers who moved to the territories would be in competition with the unpaid slaves. Consequently, Lincoln exhorted his audiences, "It's due to yourselves as voters, as owners of the new territories, that you shall keep those territories free, in the best condition for all such of your gallant sons as may choose to go there." The warm reception that Lincoln's speeches received in Iowa, Ohio, Indiana, Wisconsin, and Kansas during the last half of 1859 gave plausibility to suggestions that he ought to be nominated for high office. The idea had emerged right after the 1858 election, when some of his followers, bitter over his defeat, and convinced he's one of the best men God ever made, began to ask, "Can't we make him president or vice?" Perhaps the obscure Lacon, Illinois Gazette was the first newspaper seriously to propose Lincoln's name for the presidency. But a November 6th story in the Sandusky, Ohio Commercial Register, calling on Republicans to nominate Lincoln, received more attention. Presently, the Olney, Illinois Times began running, "Abraham Lincoln for President for 1860, below its masthead, and favorable mention of his possible candidacy appeared in papers as diverse as the New York Herald, the Rockford, Illinois Republican, and the Reading, Pennsylvania Journal. Neither Lincoln nor anybody else took these suggestions very seriously. He didn't think himself presidential timber. During the 1858 campaign against Douglas, he confided to the journalist Henry Villard that he doubted his ability to be a senator, though his wife was confident that he'd one day become president. "Just think," he exclaimed, wrapping his long arms around his knees and giving a roar of laughter, "of such a sucker as me as president." Most of the newspaper stories were intended only to suggest that Lincoln was a prominent Republican who deserved recognition as a favorite son of Illinois on the first ballot. Some of them were designed to promote his candidacy for the second place on the Republican ticket. The Hennepin, Illinois Tribune endorsed him, while frankly acknowledging that it favored William H. Seward for president, with Lincoln for vice president. Wentworth's organ, the Chicago Democrat, seemed to be endorsing Lincoln, the great man of Illinois, when it urged Republicans to nominate him for either president or vice president. But it gave the editor's game away by also recommending Lincoln for governor rather than Wentworth's arch-rival, Judd. To all such suggestions, Lincoln gave essentially the same answer. "I must in candor say I don't think myself fit for the presidency," he wrote the admiring editor of the Rock Island Register, who wanted to promote the simultaneous announcement of Lincoln's candidacy in Republican newspapers across the state. He gave an identical answer to Samuel Galloway, who was trying to organize a Lincoln for President movement in Ohio. In issuing these disclaimers, Lincoln wasn't being coy but realistic. To all outward appearances, he was less prepared to be the President of the United States than any other man who had run for that high office. Without family tradition or wealth, he'd received only the briefest of formal schooling. Now 50 years old, he had no administrative experience of any sort. He'd never been governor of his state, or even mayor of Springfield. A profound student of the Constitution and of the writings of the Founding Fathers, he had limited acquaintance with the government they had established. He'd served only a single, less than successful, term in the House of Representatives, and for the past 10 years had held no public office. Though he was one of the founders of the Republican Party, he had no close friends and only a few acquaintances in the populous eastern states whose vote would be crucial in the election. To be sure, his debates with Douglas had brought him national attention, but he'd lost the senatorial election both in 1855 and in 1859. Dismissing his chances for the presidency, one of Hatch's Boston correspondents remarked scornfully, "As for Lincoln, I'm afraid he'll kick the beam again, as he's in the habit of doing." Despite these handicaps, of which no one was more conscious than Lincoln himself, he did think about the presidency. Indeed, any public man with intelligence and ambition, looking over the sorry run of recent chief executives, was forced to consider whether he couldn't occupy the White House as satisfactorily as, say, Franklin Pierce or James Buchanan. When Lincoln allowed himself to consider the possibility of running for president, his chances for securing the Republican nomination seemed better than average. The party had several strong candidates, but all had flaws. The leading name was William H. Seward, the senator and former governor of New York, an unquestionably able, experienced, and adroit politician of Whig antecedents, who was handicapped by an undeserved reputation for extremism because of his speeches proclaiming a higher law than the Constitution and predicting an irrepressible conflict between slavery and freedom. In addition, his emphatic opposition to nativism would alienate former know-nothing voters. Pennsylvania Republicans, irate because the low tariff of 1857 had removed protection from their iron industry, mostly favored Simon Cameron. But he had few followers outside that state and was widely suspected of financial improprieties or even gross corruption. Salmon P. Chase, the Republican governor of Ohio, earnestly sought the nomination, and many of the more dedicated anti-slavery members of the party backed him. But he lacked personal magnetism, as well as political adroitness. Another possibility was Edward Bates of Missouri, a conservative, free-soil Whig, now 66 years old, who wasn't even a member of the Republican Party. He was the improbable favorite of the erratic Horace Greeley, who was willing to back anybody who could defeat his former friend and now bitter rival, Seward. In addition to these front-runners, there were secondary candidates who might become winners if the convention was deadlocked. John C. Fremont, the defeated Republican candidate in 1856, William L. Dayton of New Jersey, who had been Fremont's running mate, Cassius M. Clay, the fiery, unstable Kentucky abolitionist, and Benjamin F. Wade, the blunt anti-slavery senator and Chase's principal rival in Ohio. Shrewdly, Lincoln recognized that his own chances against these better-known rivals could best be advanced not by an open announcement of his candidacy, but by small private moves to consolidate his strength and expand his influence. To ensure wider circulation of his ideas, he took an active role in compiling and preserving his 1858 debates with Douglas. With the assistance of Henry C. Whitney, he collected the reports of his speeches that appeared in the Chicago Press and Tribune and those of Douglas in the Chicago Times. These he carefully pasted in a large scrapbook, which he hoped to have published. After plans for having a book printed in Springfield failed, he turned over the project to Follett, Foster and Company of Columbus, Ohio, which shortly before the National Nominating Conventions of 1860 issued a 268-page book titled Political Debates Between Honorable Abraham Lincoln and Honorable Stephen A. Douglas in the celebrated campaign of 1858 in Illinois. It immediately became a bestseller. In December 1859, Lincoln made another quiet move to gain broader recognition by preparing an autobiography for campaign purposes. Jesse W. Fell, a Bloomington politician, forwarded a request from Joseph J. Lewis of the Chester County, Pennsylvania Times for biographical information he could use in preparing an article on Lincoln. Lincoln complied with a terse sketch that reviewed his homespun beginnings, summarized his public career, and ended, "If any personal description of me is thought desirable, it may be said I am in height 6 feet 4 inches, nearly, lean in flesh, weighing on an average 180 pounds, dark complexion with coarse black hair and gray eyes, no other marks or brands recollected." This he sent to Fell, noting, "There's not much of it, for the reason, I suppose, that there's not much of me." Lewis evidently found the sketch meager, for he embroidered it with remarks on Lincoln's oratorical gifts and on his long record of support for a protective tariff, so dear to Pennsylvanians. His article, widely copied in other Republican newspapers, was the first published biography of Lincoln. An even stronger indication of Lincoln's growing interest in a presidential race was the alacrity with which he accepted an invitation from New York to lecture at Henry Ward Beecher's Plymouth Church in Brooklyn in February 1860. Knowing that he'd appear before a sophisticated Eastern audience, he promptly began more careful research and preparation than for any other speech in his life. He also ordered a brand new black suit for the occasion, for which he paid the local tailors, Woods and Henkel, $100. By the time he arrived in the East, sponsorship of the address had been taken over by the Young Men's Central Republican Union, a body that included 65-year-old William Cullen Bryant, 49-year-old Horace Greeley, and other such youths who were organizing a Stop Seward movement. Lincoln's was the third in a series of lectures, following addresses by Frank Blair, the Missouri anti-slavery leader, and Cassius M. Clay, the Kentucky abolitionist, designed, according to the sponsors, to call out our better but busier citizens who never attend political meetings. Without informing Lincoln, the young Republicans also shifted the lecture from Brooklyn to the Cooper Union in Manhattan. Learning of the change after he arrived and registered at the Astor House, Lincoln spent his first day in New York revising his address so as to make it more suitable for a general political audience than for a religious congregation. On Monday, February 27th, escorted by several of the young Republicans, he caught a glimpse of Broadway and had his photograph, which he called his shadow, taken at Matthew B. Brady's studio, where he exchanged pleasantries with George Bancroft. "I'm on my way to Massachusetts," Lincoln told the historian, "where I have a son at school who, if report be true, already knows much more than his father." The portrait Brady produced after this sitting was a work of art. He retouched the negative in order to correct Lincoln's left eye that seemed to be roving upward, and eliminated harsh lines from his face to show an almost handsome, statesmanlike image. That night, after a warm introduction by Bryant, Lincoln appeared before a capacity audience at the Cooper Union. Many of his listeners expected something weird, rough, and uncultivated, George Haven Putnam remembered, and Lincoln's appearance did nothing to undeceive them. The long, ungainly figure upon which hung clothes that, while new for the trip, were evidently the work of an unskilled tailor, the large feet, the clumsy hands, of which the orator seemed to be unduly conscious, the long, gaunt head, capped by a shock of hair that seemed not to have been thoroughly brushed out, Putnam continued, made a picture which didn't fit in with New York's conception of a finished statesman. Equally disconcerting was Lincoln's voice, for it was high and piercing in tone at the outset. But the speech he delivered, reading carefully and soberly from sheets of blue foolscap, quickly erased the impression of a crude frontiersman. It was a masterful exploration of the political paths open to the nation. In the first third of the address, Lincoln closely examined Douglas's contention that popular sovereignty was simply a continuation of a policy initiated by the Founding Fathers. After digging through the records of the Constitutional Convention and the debates in the earliest Congresses, he was able to show that of the 39 signers of the Constitution, at least 21 demonstrated by their votes that the federal government had the power to control slavery in the national territories. Other noted anti-slavery men, like Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, and Governor Morris, should probably be added to that list, though they were not called to vote on this specific question. This minutely detailed record confirmed a position that Lincoln had been arguing for years, that prior to Douglas's introduction of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, it was impossible to show that any living man in the whole world ever did declare that the Constitution forbade the federal government to control as to slavery in the federal territories. Next, Lincoln examined the Southern position, though he had little hope that his arguments would be heard, much less heeded, in that section. Nevertheless, he seized the opportunity to argue that the Republicans were the true conservatives on questions relating to slavery. They adhered to the old and tried against the new and untried, while Southern fire-eaters, with one accord, reject and scout and spit upon that old policy. This gave him a welcome opening to explain the Republican attitude toward the raid that John Brown and a handful of zealous followers had staged in October 1859 on Harper's Ferry, Virginia. At that time, Lincoln denounced Brown's attempt to stir up an insurrection among the slaves as wrong for two reasons. It was a violation of law, and it was, as all such attacks must be, futile as far as any effect it might have on the extinction of a great evil. Though he'd paid tribute to Brown's great courage, rare unselfishness, and sympathized with his hatred of slavery, he concluded that the old abolitionist was insane. Now he took the offensive, pointing out that Brown's raid was not a slave insurrection, but an attempt by white men to get up a revolt among slaves in which the slaves refused to participate. Further, he pointed out, Southerners, after an elaborate congressional investigation, had failed to implicate a single Republican in it. Southern efforts to capitalize on John Brown's raid were simply additional evidence of their determination to rule or ruin in all events. More recently, Southerners had gone so far as to announce that if a Republican was elected president in 1860, the Union would be dissolved and the fault would be the North's. "That's cool," Lincoln exclaimed. "A highwayman holds a pistol to my ear and mutters through his teeth, 'Stand and deliver, or I shall kill you, and then you'll be a murderer.'" What should Northerners do? Avoiding both the moral indifference with which Douglas approached the slavery issue and the pro-slavery zeal of the Southern radicals, Republicans should fearlessly and effectively persist in excluding slavery from the national territories, confining it to the states where it already existed. "Neither let us be slandered from our duty by false accusations against us, nor frightened from it by menaces of destruction to the government, nor of dungeons to ourselves," Lincoln announced in his spine-tingling peroration. "Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith, let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it." As a speech, it was a superb performance. The audience frequently applauded during the delivery of the address, and when Lincoln closed, the crowd cheered and stood, waving handkerchiefs and hats. Noah Brooks, then working for the New York Tribune, exclaimed, "He's the greatest man since St. Paul." And a student at the Harvard Law School, trained to master his emotions, told his father, "It was the best speech I ever heard." The next day, four New York papers printed the address in full. Bryant, in the New York Evening Post, called it forcible and most logically and convincingly stated. Greeley, less restrained, announced, "Mr. Lincoln is one of nature's orators, using his rare powers solely and effectively to elucidate and to convince, though their inevitable effect is to delight and electrify as well." Immediately published in pamphlet form, the Cooper Union Address was issued and reissued as a Republican tract by the New York Tribune, the Chicago Press and Tribune, the Detroit Tribune, and the Albany Evening Journal. It was also a superb political move for an unannounced presidential aspirant. Appearing in Seward's home state, sponsored by a group largely loyal to Chase, Lincoln shrewdly made no reference to either of these Republican rivals for the nomination. Recognizing that if the Republicans were going to win in 1860, they needed the support of men who'd voted for Fillmore in the previous election, Lincoln, in his Cooper Union address, stressed his conservatism. He didn't mention his House divided thesis or Seward's irrepressible conflict prediction. Republicans were presented as a party of moderates who were simply trying to preserve the legacy of the Founding Fathers against the radical assaults of the pro-slavery element. Even Lincoln's language contributed to the effect he sought. The careful structure of the speech, the absence of incendiary rhetoric, even the laborious recital of the voting records of the Founding Fathers, all suggested reasonableness and stability, not wide-eyed fanaticism. In short, it was, as one of the sponsors wrote, an enormous success. Sending Lincoln the agreed-upon fee of $200, he added, "I would that it were $200,000, for you're worthy of it." The next day, Lincoln moved on to New England, ostensibly to visit Robert, who'd enrolled in the Phillips Exeter Academy the previous September. Of course, he was glad to see his son and to chat with his schoolmates. When one of them produced a banjo and gave an informal concert for the visitor, Lincoln was genuinely pleased and said to his stiff, unmusical son, "Robert, you ought to have one." But it quickly became clear that the real object of his visit was to cement connections with influential Republicans who'd be attending the forthcoming national convention. After the success of the Cooper Union address, Lincoln was something of a lion, much in demand at Republican rallies. And during his 4 days with Robert, he made campaign addresses at Concord, Manchester, Dover, and Exeter. On the last of these occasions, many of the boys from the academy turned out, and he had an audience of about 500 people. The students, who knew Bob as a gentleman in every sense of the word, quiet in manner, with a certain dignity of his own, were astonished when Lincoln came into the hall, tall, lank, awkward, dressed in a loose, ill-fitting black frock coat with black trousers, ill-fitting and somewhat baggy at the knees. They observed his rumpled hair, his necktie turned awry, and his long legs that seemed to fit neither under or around his chair. "Isn't it too bad Bob's father is so homely?" they whispered to each other. "Don't you feel sorry for him?" But after Lincoln disentangled his legs, rose slowly from his chair, and began speaking, they forgot his appearance. They no longer pitied Bob, but felt proud to know his father. During his 2 weeks in New England, Lincoln spoke nearly every day, avoiding Massachusetts, which was a Seward stronghold, but attempting to help the Republican candidates in Rhode Island, New Hampshire, and Connecticut. He found it hard work. So many in his audiences had read the Cooper Union address that he couldn't simply repeat that speech. and he had to try to think of new ways of presenting his ideas. Perhaps his most telling innovation was his explanation of why Republicans firmly opposed to the extension of slavery were not pledged to eradicate it in the southern states. If out on the street or in the field or on the prairie I find a rattlesnake, Lincoln explained, I take a stake and kill him. Everybody would applaud the act and say I did right. But suppose the snake was in a bed where children were sleeping. Would I do right to strike him there? I might hurt the children. Or I might not kill, but only arouse and exasperate the snake, and he might bite the children. The best way to end slavery, he insisted, was firmly to oppose its spread into the national territories. On this issue, there could be no compromise. Let us stand by our duty fearlessly and effectively, he urged over and over again, often ending with the peroration of his Cooper Union address. Let us have faith that right makes might, and in that faith, let us, to the end, dare to do our duty as we understand it. The success of Lincoln's Eastern trip edged him a step closer to becoming an avowed candidate for the Republican presidential nomination. As recently as January, he'd been hesitant about making a race. Conferring with Judd, Hatch, Jackson Grimshaw, and a few other prominent Illinois Republicans who pressed him to run, he expressed doubt whether he could get the nomination if he wished it. Only after a night of reflection, and doubtless of conferences with Mary Lincoln, who was even more ambitious than he was, did he authorize the little group to work quietly for his nomination. Even then, he didn't consider himself a serious candidate, but hoped that endorsement as a favorite son would help unite the Illinois Republicans and confirm his party leadership. He explained that he was not in a position where it would hurt much for me to not be nominated on the national ticket, but that it would hurt some for me to not get the Illinois delegates at the Republican convention. But after his return from New York and New England, he made no attempt to conceal his desire for the nomination. By April, he wrote to Trumbull, who inquired about his intentions, I'll be entirely frank. The taste is in my mouth a little.
This ends Disc 13.